Do indicate if you can't hear me. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Homage to the Buddha, the Blessed Noble, and Fully Self-Enlightened One. So this is hopefully a reminder to some, and to those of you who are new, just really being very clear about three things that we need to know in order to meditate properly, insight meditation, Vipassana. The first one is to be very clear about what the Buddha means by right awareness. A lot about mindfulness these days, but there's such a thing as right mindfulness. Secondly, how to deal with those things that take us away from right mindfulness, all the distractions and so on. And thirdly, how we what it is we're actually investigating. That's important. To understand right mindfulness, it's always good to recall the life story of the Buddha, at least in short. So remember that he's left his family really in what we would call an existential crisis. So he's come out of youth and he recognises that now it's all downhill. It's all sickness, ageing and death awaiting him. So it's a bit of an abrupt awakening, I think. Or a slow dawning anyway. But at some point he recognises, or he begins to realise that there is suffering. It might not have been so clear to him in his youth. The horror of the age, of course, was rebirth, reincarnation, the idea that you would come back and start all over again. See, so there were plenty of people who were leaving the ordinary household life and trying to discover happiness, true happiness, or at least the end of suffering or something. When he left, he joined two teachers who taught him how to establish ecstasy. So these you find in all religions, created by repetitive prayer, mantra, devotional prayer. And it's basically a heightened form of mental state which we can create within ourselves. The joy of it is that you don't need anything. So you can just live on a couple of potatoes and a shed, and you'll be completely blissed out. On both the teachers, he was such an adept that they invited him to be a teacher, and both times he says he wasn't happy with it. Basically, he found that, of course, when the mental state disappeared, when his ecstasy disappeared, he was still back to being the anxious, depressed Gautama. So he wandered off and he tried something else, which was quite regular in those days, which were ascetic practices. So here the understanding, which was especially taught by the Jain leader, Nigantha, was that the body was what was holding the soul down. And somehow if you would release your attachment to the body, the soul would rise naturally to a heavenly state. And so your body was actually a material form of your karma, your bad karma. And the idea was to deny the body all its pleasures, because the root problem lay in the body, not in the mind. You know, if the body never felt hungry, then you'd never suffer from greed. It's as simple as that. So the Jain saint is one who starves themselves to death. And they really are heroes in their society. And it's a way of saying that they've let go of this form of life, you see. So he tried that. And in his own way, he discovered that was just more suffering. So he said he starved himself to a point where he could hold his stomach. Hold his spine through his stomach. So if you can try that, you'll see how thin he was. Anyway, he leaves that, and he's supposedly looking a bit wretched. He leaves his companions. His companions actually blame him. He's gone soft. So he's sitting by the roadside looking pretty dreadful, I think. And a woman comes across. For some reason, her name's come down to Sujata, which means an auspicious birth. And she's carrying some offerings for the local god, the local shrine. And when she sees this wretch opposite to him, of course in the scriptures that he glowed like a god, you know, I can't believe it. So anyway, when he takes this food, he's revived. And at this point, he seems to have had a memory of his father doing a plowing ceremony as a child. And this is why we say he's self-enlightened, because it was this memory that made him rethink about the way he was approaching this problem. He remembers watching his father doing a plowing ceremony, and he was in the same state of concentration, but there was something added, and that was his curiosity, like, what's my dad doing? And so that turned his whole quest around upon itself. Instead of seeking happiness, he began to turn round and ask what was the cause of suffering. And it was with this sort of renewed interest that he sat under a tree we call the Bodhi tree, the enlightened tree, it's the religious fig tree. Very shady, it's huge. And he decided that he would sit and either crack this problem or die. See, so I always say, very lucky for him, lucky for us. He made it, you see. And in order to understand what this right awareness is, we've got to go back to that childhood mind, you see. So just recall what it's like when you see a child under the age of 7, but even afterwards, how when they've not seen something, like a bug, you know. I've got a picture of a little child doing that. And her eyes are fixed on this creature, this little insect. And the jaw's dropped, see. So from our more elevated point of view, she looks gormless. And you'd want to sort of give her a clip on the back of the head and say, wake up. But the fact is that that glue, the way the eyes of a child glue on something, you know, is their concentration. Other stuff can be going on around them, they won't hear it. They're just absolutely glued on what they're looking at. And the jaw dropping means the mind has stopped. Okay? So when you're in your meditation, if your jaw's relaxed, it's helping the thinking mind stopping. And sometimes, if you can sometimes feel the little vibrations on your tongue as thoughts arise, because they're so intimately connected. So the fact that the child's jaw is dropped means that they're not thinking. What state are they in? They're in that state that we were trying to develop when we were doing standing meditation. Just receiving. See? No blocking, no coming from any position, no saying, well, you know, I shouldn't be looking at this. There's no philosophy, there's no conceptual thinking. It's just completely open because they've never seen it before. Now what happens is, of course, that the child then stops and turns around and asks, Mummy or Daddy, what is it, you see? And they say, well, it's a beetle. Now, what happens is that the mind then makes a photocopy, okay? So that's your percept, that's your perception. And the more beetles that this child sees, different types of beetles, this perception turns into a concept of beetle. So every time they see a beetle from then on, they just say, oh, it's a beetle. They never look at it. We never look at a beetle, we just know it's a beetle, and that's the end of it. And it fits into our mental concept that we've plonked onto this little creature. How do we get back to that ability to see the beetle as if we'd never seen one before? See? You have to go right back to the sense base. And I'll be... it's more easy to do that when we're doing something slightly more physical, like eating. So just before lunch, you know, we'll at lunchtime we'll have the opportunity to see how it's possible to get right back down to that childlike way of seeing things. Okay? So if you've got... When you sit, if you can just bring that picture of a child to mind, that you're just watching, just feeling, just experiencing, not interfering, yeah? You're not trying to come from some place, you're not trying to understand anything, you're just absorbing, you see. And of course, you have to have a certain faith that there is within us this intuitive intelligence which grasps things, you know, we call it insight. And of course, we're using it all the time, because it's the only intelligence we actually have. It becomes distorted through the intellect, you know. Like the story I normally tell is about, you know, Archimedes. I mean, when he's been trying to get this specific gravity of this crown, hasn't he, to prove it's gold. So he's got the weight of it. That's easy enough. But how do you get the volume of an irregular shape? You see, so he must have been scratching his head, etc., etc. And then he thought, to hell with this, and he went and had the bath. And as he's there, completely relaxed, you see, and as he slips into the bath, he realizes, oh, this is it. So it's that sort of, those little eureka moments happening to us all the time. You know, it's not as though it's specific to the spiritual life. It happens in art, in science, just in ordinary conversation. You might just understand something. Okay, so we have to get back to that childlike way of looking at things. Now, what stops us doing that? Well, we call them the hindrances. So these are all the things that take us away on these fantasies. So there's only two types, really. There's those that fling us out like a whirlwind, okay? So we're constantly fantasizing about something, so we're getting angry about or upset about, or we're planning this huge holiday to South America. See, so it always, the mind's always moving in these clouds of virtual reality. So what do we do? It's always the same technique. You always come out of it, right? And then you reflect, what was that about? See? And you're interested in attitude. Now be careful here, because the attitude is not the same as an emotion. Okay? You might feel the emotion, you might be feeling irritated about something, in which case you would come back into the body, stay with that feeling, right? Let the heart express itself in its rawness, and that's the therapy, right? If you allow the heart to express itself as a physical feeling, it's releasing its energy, you're liberating it, you might say. But sometimes you're wanting to come back into the body, you can't feel anything at all, you see, but you know that there must be some anger in the system somewhere, or some fear, or some anxiety. So attitude is more to do with our general relationship to something, right? And it's driven by the will, it's produced by the will, either from a position of wisdom or lack of it. The heart then, of course, responds to it, and that's when we feel angry, see? Or feel anxious, or feel happy, okay? So as soon as you come out of one of these fantasies, really recognize what's happening there. Judging, see? Jealous. We very rarely catch our jealousy thoughts, because that's a downer, isn't it? Because you're basically saying to yourself, you're less than this person. So it's a difficult one to catch, jealousy. But you just try and catch your jealousy. So then you come back into the body. If you can feel the associate feelings with it, stay with it. See, let them burn, see. And that's all you have to do. That's the healing of the heart. If there's nothing there, you just go back to the breath, that's all, okay? Sometimes the mind's just busy, it's just gone berserk, you see. So be very patient, just keep coming back. And you might notice your relation to what's happening, how you're judging what you're experiencing. So if you have a thought, you know, he just murdered somebody, oh, I shouldn't be doing that. Because they're judging. See? Always keep coming, always step back from what you're actually experiencing and then reflecting on it, okay? So that's just right across the board, doesn't matter what's taking your mind off. The other one, of course, is like a whirlpool, right? It's that slipping into sweet oblivion through sleep and dullness. So remember, there is a natural tiredness. There's no problem with that. It's just this overlay that we put on it, seeking happiness, you know, in sleep, in doziness. So just think about the times when you've just, you know, kept hitting the snooze button, you know, for 2 hours. or when you felt a bit down, a bit depressed, you just laid out on the couch and disappeared for a couple of hours. So all these are sort of little ways in which we commit suicide. A gentle suicide of just getting rid of ourselves a while. And when we're doing that, unwittingly, we've created a conditioning within us, you see. Conditioning. And that's conditioning. It's just like getting angry or getting depressed about something. And when that happens, of course, the intention is always to remain fully awake. And the way you can do that is by investigating those dull feelings in the mind, the heaviness of the body. Keep the attention moving around, you see. That keeps you awake. If it gets over the powering, you just open your eyes. You can open them wide, you see. But although the light's coming in keeping you awake, your attention is still inward. Yeah. Then you can always stand up. But every time you fall into that state of sleep as a habit, whether you like it or not, you've added a bit more energy to that practice. See? Remember, every time your mind wanders, it's actually developing the mental state. Even at habitual level. See? So that's, I mean, you know, that's why when you somebody says something irritating to you in the morning, if you don't catch it and allow that irritation to burn out, you know, it comes back at a break, doesn't it? I don't know, it's not the same. And it carries on all through the day, so you get a headache. So really, that's one thing we've really got to understand. Every time the mind wanders, it's not doing us any good. Okay, it's very different from directive thinking, from purposeful thinking. And when you realise that, when you really realise that, of course you're very careful during daily life not to let the mind just shoot off on these little fantasies. So those are the two types, right? There's those that let the mind wander, and we just come out of it, we're very clear about what the attitude is of driving it. We come into the body, we try and feel if there's an emotional value put to it. If not, you go back to the breath. Always the same technique. And when it's dullness and lethargy, you determine to stay awake, and you just make those feelings objects to observe, to feel. And then finally, there's these three characteristics of existence. Remember, the Buddha's declared aim is to understand suffering and to bring it to an end. It's as simple as that. So where does this suffering lie? It lies, first of all, in our relationship to things. So we talk about attachment. But what is an attachment? Well, attachment is a psychological dependency on something over which we can't control for our happiness. It's ridiculous. You know, happiness and chocolate bars. Or, I mean, can you imagine waking up one morning and there's no tea in the house? Oh, my God. That's just awful. The idea is there. It's a big banner. So you can see where your attachments are, because you've always had this negativity to it. You see the frustration, the grief, that loss, all that sort of stuff. So what we're trying to do is to recognise where the attachments are. And they start off with this always wanting things to be different from what they actually are. We're never ready to accept the situation as it is, or very rarely do we accept the situation as it actually is. And when we do that, of course, you have to be careful not to fall into the error of resignation, by which I mean can't do anything about this, moves you towards despair. Whereas what we want is an acceptance of it in that brightness, because simply because things change, there's always potential. You always work with the situation. So the first thing is to recognize this process of desire, which splits into wanting and not wanting. Wanting and not wanting. Now, it's not as though all desires are unwholesome. The desire to meditate is not unwholesome. We should obviously develop that. All those desires coming from the good heart, we should develop. But it's recognizing that there are certain desires which are really causing us a lot of problems. And it's the start of it is to recognize this process of constantly reacting to things because of old habits. Okay? So in your meditation, when you see that, the judging, don't want this, shouldn't be doing that. Why isn't it like this? You know, where's this from? So as soon as you see that, note it as desiring. Now, sometimes when your mind goes off on a fantasy, for instance, and you come back to the body, if you stay with the feeling, suppose there's excitement there, you've been planning this amazing business move, create billions of pounds, and it's all here in the heart, it's all very exciting. If you stay there close to it, you can feel there's a leakage of energy. The leakage of energy, and that's the desire, you see, that's the wanting to go back into the intellect and create this imaginary world. If you can just stay with that and wait for it to die out, you'll see the mind stops. Then you'll see the connection between the heart and the mind, you see. So desire is this wrong desire. So we don't really have a good translation for this word tanha. It's often translated as craving, but I always think that's a bit too strong. I mean, there are cravings, but it's not just the cravings we're worried about. We're concerned with all sorts of desires. The next one is this sense of impermanence. See? How the mind creates continuity for us. It's a wonderful, it's amazing how, you know, from such small amounts of input from the world, the mind can create this world that we're actually living in. So when we're doing standing meditation and we are observing what's inside us and then what's outside us, it's all being created in this, you know, the Buddha says suffering and the end of suffering is contained in this fathom-length body. It's all happening here. See? So it's recognizing that the mind has this capacity to make things look continuous. I always feel it's me, you know. When I wake up, it's the same me that went to sleep. It's the same me that was there when I was three. It's ridiculous, isn't it? So it's recognizing that there's something wrong with the way I'm perceiving the world. I'm perceiving it as continuous. Right? What undermines that sort of perception is to catch the end of things, the end of the breath, the end of the footstep. Right? We don't like seeing ends. Before the end comes, we're already on to the next thing to be done. We're all looking for, you know, like, what we're going to do this Friday. Like, it's always, we're always well ahead of ourselves. See? But when we stick to that, to the ending of things, you see, they're all endings are little momentary deaths. Right? We don't like to be there. We don't like to be at the point of an ending of something. So really bring your mind to seeing the ending of things if you want to see this process of impermanence. And the final one is this not self. So the Buddha never said there was no self. Huh? There is a self, he just said it wasn't real, which is different. So you sometimes get confused with these translations. It's just a technique in which you are looking at what you're experiencing and saying, well, that's not me. So in our sitting meditation, I was pointing out that everything you're observing in your meditation, you're observing it. There's a separation, isn't there, between what's observing and what's being actually observed, what's feeling and what's being felt. Am I correct? Very good, I expect vigorous nodding. So this objectivity means it can't be the perceiver, see? The perceiver can't be the perceived, see, absolutely. So I'll work on that one. And the fact that it's not under our control. So this is in the second discourse the Buddha gives, he points out that we're not in control. We have this minimal control of the body. I mean, I can make it stand up and sit down and all that. But, you know, I always wanted to be 6'6". So it's a case of recognizing that our control over the body, just at the level of the body, is absolutely minimal. I mean, have you any idea now what's happening in the marrow of your bones? See, there's thousands, I don't know, you have to believe these things. There are millions of red corpuscles making their way through your bone. It's amazing, isn't it? And white corpuscles, I think, too. Do you have any idea what's happening to your, what's happening in your liver at this present moment? These don't know. And yet we live in this sort of sublime world that we think we're the body. So it's the same with the mind. We don't know what the mind's capable of, you know. You don't know what's going to... I mean, one of the things that always shocks people, often shocks people when they begin to sit, is that they, you know, they knew they were a bit depressed, but didn't think they were that depressed. But they're suddenly opening up to themselves, in a way. So there's all this subterranean stuff that we're not fully aware of. I think Freud understood that very well, too. So those two ways of looking at what we're experiencing, that they are objects and that we're not in control, is drawing us back to a position within ourselves of the observer, okay? And for those of you who've meditated a long time, you see, when you get to that state of being the observer, when it's like very clear in yourself, and everything's quiet, the mind's silent, the heart's calm, body still, you get a really strong sense of, you know, I am the observer. So remember, you're also aware of that, so you can't be that either. Okay? So that's when you get into a real paradox. So when you're like that, really draw your attention to the feel of your presence. Right? Now, when you look into a mirror, you see your face looking at you, don't you? Your face is looking at you. And we actually believe that that's how people see us. Correct? How many people have done the two mirror trick? Oh, I'm absolutely amazed. Thank you, Lee. Very good. One person, is that correct? Only one? Well, you must do it. It's two. Very good. First thing you do when you get home, you get two mirrors. And you look into one mirror, and then with this mirror, you look actually into the mirror, right, to turn your face round. And you're looking at your face in this turnaround. Okay? And that's how people see you. It's always a shock. It's like hearing your voice recorded for the first time. So you never thought your nose was that big. So it's a case of recognizing that when you look into a mirror, see, that's not how people see you, and yet you think they do. It's an amazing delusion. See, now the funny thing about mirrors is that this face is looking back at you. Okay, so when you're in a state of the observer, the clear state of the observer, the field of the observer, see, it's a mirror image of the Buddha nature within you. That's why the Buddha says, those who are mindful are in the presence of Nibbana. Okay, so when you're in that state, really investigate that, the feel, the presence, which seems to give us the idea that of a me. That's at its most subtle level. Okay, sense of presence. often confused with the soul or the spirit or something. So when we begin to meditate, we are bring that image of a child to mind, to get that original way of looking at things. In Zen, you see, original mind, beginner's mind, beginner's mind. That's what they're talking about. Secondly, when the mind is creating all these diversions for us, remember that all you've got to do is come out of these fantasies, recognize the attitude, feel it. If it's not there, just go back to the breath. Feeling sleepy or tired, make those sensations objects to observe, to feel, get into the nitty-gritty of it. And the three characteristics, you know, this process of desire, right? Really make that very clear to yourself. And the impermanence, how we create continuity, and the sense of not me, not mine. Now, according to the commentaries, any of those three can be taken right directly to liberation. So just investigating how we create suffering for ourselves is enough to take us all the way. Yeah? I can only hope my words have been of some assistance, that they have not caused even greater confusion. And with your deliberate devotion to your practice, you may be liberated sooner rather than later.